Okay, so it's a pleasure and honor to introduce our friend and colleague, Vance Stevens. He has been in this field, in the field of language teaching, for 20 years, and Vance Stevens actively pursues professional development as educational technology consultant, online facilitator and coach, and founder and moderator of Webheads Community of Practice. That's a pleasure to see now. We've been members of all these communities for a long time. It's a pleasure that you are joined us. You joined us at this conference. So I would like, Nelly is trying to tell me, she's with me on Google Talk. Just Nelly, I will take care of this until I give the floor to Vance. So Vance, this is your presentation, and you can start. And I will take care of the interface. So I mute my mic. You are on.
Okay, well, thank you very much. That was a nice introduction. Thank you. I'm Vance Stevens, and this is my presentation about what I've just for fun started calling me portfolios, a little alteration, putting the me in me learning. And progress through the slides, it comes up okay. This is what the presentation is going to be about. Basically, I'm going to start by talking a little bit about how I got into e-learning and how I evolved my mobile beginnings. Oh, okay. My video just went off and came back on. I'm not really sure why it did that. And then I've been lately getting involved in MOOCs, Massive Open Online Courses, and I've been trying to run my, well, actually, I think I was running my multi literacies course as a MOOC before MOOCs kind of came about, before that term was coined. But anyway, that's what I'm going to be talking about. And I'd like to say hello to Distilla and to Marita, who both greet me in text chat. So anyway, let me tell you also on the next slide, this is going to tell you where you can find all the artifacts of this course. I created a paper, I wrote it out, and you can go to that tiny URL to read pretty much what I'm going to say, get all the links. If you miss anything, or you nod off, or you have to get up and go somewhere, then you can see it all there, you can read it. And the slides, these slides, are at slideshare.net, and you can go there, you can see that. And you can also click on the multiliteracies course, which is goodbyegutenberg.pdworks.com. That was a brainchild of Neville Quintana, who kind of came up with that topic. And at one point, she was co-moderating the course for Electronic Village Online. And the people that you see in this collage here are participants in the last multiliteracies course that we ran for the TESOL Principles and Practices of Online Teaching. So I'm going to talk about all of that and run it all together. Okay, so to start off, this is how I got involved in e-learning. Well, basically, I should have started in 2002, or even before that. Actually, I got started in 1998 when I came from Oman to California, and I had been teaching in Oman and got into software development. And I then started teaching for something called Study.com, and that was kind of an online email course back in 1998. So eventually, we sort of moved into online spaces such as the Palace. And then I got a job in Abu Dhabi, and I moved there, and I sort of started hanging out in some of these online spaces and gathering students together, and I met coincidentally Michael Coghlan and Maggie Doty, and so we kind of started teaching and together because we are our times butted up against one another, and then I started a portal for the students who were gathering with us, and we called that Writing for Web, and that's really how WebBits got started. So that went along from 1998 up until about 2001 when we had started broadcasting some of our Writing for WebBits events online and experimenting with voice chats. That you could actually just install plugins on your website and you could talk to one another, kind of like you're doing Skype now. But that was on your website. So the teachers started getting really interested in this and started joining this group and started suppressing the student voices. So in 2002, I decided to teach the teachers, sort of create a teacher group, which we called WebEds in Action. And I did this through Electronic Village Online, which is a TESOL course. And so I guess I had to start with that in order to lead into the 2003 TESOL Online Academy course, because as a result of the 2002 Electronic Village Online course, I was asked to teach this course. And there's a link to it if you want to see more about it. It was called Enhancing Online Communities with Voice and Webcam. And since then, though, after that, the year after that, I was asked to teach in the fee-based Principles and Practices of Online Teaching program. And there's a link to its home online on the TESOL website. And also, if you click on the, if I click on a link, does that go somewhere? No, it just opens a link in my browser. That's doesn't open any links. But anyway, you can click on the links. In 2007, once I taught that course for a few years, I started making wikis. I started out teaching that course kind of in a Web 1.0 way. So I'm going to talk a little bit more about that. But by 2007, I had come to put wikis up for the students and have them put online things that we used to call portfolios. So these are the Electronic Village Online sessions I've conducted. You can see that, and in case you don't know about the EVO, it's not really a TESOL created event. It's a TESOL sponsored event. And that way, because it has teachers who are members of TESOL, and they started it also through the Computer Assisted Language Learning Interest Session. So if you don't know about the EVO, you should definitely check it out. I didn't put a link for it, but it's evosessions.pbworks.com. You can find that in the written version of the talk that I'm giving right now. And so these sessions are all proposed about now, this time of year. Now we're in August, so September actually is the deadline for next year. The call for proposals is in September coming up, from the 25th, if you want to propose a session, you can. And I proposed all these sessions starting in 2002, whether it's in action, and that's got a link now with it.info. And then in 2003, we started doing the community. We studied ourselves as a community practice. And then I started teaching something called web presence, and that was why I asked to teach that thing on webcams. And I did something called Webcast Academy in 2007. And here again, you can find all the links here. Blogging for Educators was, we were just part of that session. We took a week and we talked about Writing Matrix. Now, Writing Matrix was very interesting. I suggest you click on that link for Writing Matrix. That was a project where we wanted to learn how tagging might work to get students together. So teachers from around the world, in Argentina, Venezuela, Slovenia, got their students blogging, and they had the students tag their blog posts Writing Matrix. Now, if you... But in order to do this successfully, you have to find a tag that no one else is using. So we put Lightning Matrix into the tag search engines, and we found that there nothing came up. So in other words, Lightning Matrix was our tag. So when we had the students start blogging and tagging the posts Lightning Matrix, they found each other. And that had some really interesting affordances. For one thing, the students became very interested in blogging, and some of them even started continued blogging through the summer. And the teachers noticed a lot of enthusiasm for that kind of activity. There's some nice videos that we designed. They were produced from the students in Argentina, for example. And if you go to that Lightning Matrix site, wikispaces.com link, you'll find more artifacts like that online. And so more recently, I've done a multiple literacies course, and I'm going to talk a little bit about how that got started. As I said, the multiple literacies course looks a little bit like a MOOC. It's always been an open course. It's part of the PPOT, or Principles and Practices of Online Teaching program in PSOL, and it's a fee-based course, which means that PSOL kind of advertises it on its website, and it's a part of a program that teaches people about teaching online, Principles and Practices of Online Teaching. And the course normally runs in Desire to Learn, which is a learning management system, or LMS. And my course, the idea is that the setup of the course is in Desire to Learn, but some teachers branch out from Desire to Learn, me perhaps more than others. I've been running the course in open space. It's very important. So whereas it's kind of conceived as the question in the text chat is, can you get the PowerPoint? Can you get the URL? If someone would look in, the tiny URL here. Yes, that's fine. It's also on Twitter under Vance's. I put a link. That's a good one. Twitter.com/Vance's. It'll take you to the paper that I've written to accompany this presentation, and all the links are there. If someone could put those links in the chat, that would be most convenient. Okay, anyway, as I was saying, if that gets resolved, let us know, and I won't worry about it anymore. Okay, so goodbye Gutenberg.pbworks.com is the latest portal that we came up with multiple literacies. Basically, that's an online portal. It's much different from Desire to Learn. Desire to Learn has the spaces are everything is locked down. You have to have a password to get in, and you can't really see the course once it's stopped. But with open courses, they're not locked down. They occur on the internet, like Nelly's courses. Everything Nelly does is open. My course also encouraged community. Whereas most courses were conceived as being run through Desire to Learn, yes, that Goodbye Gutenberg just came up in the thank you, Jeff, that was in the audience. He just put in the slideshow. Yeah, that slide share actually would play this slideshow in such a way that you can click on the links. So either of those links will get you the links. Thank you for following so closely. So anyway, my course, because I controlled the spaces, the spaces were mine, anybody could get into them. And so I didn't have to just, I could tell people that, I could invite people to the course. I didn't have to go just with people who were enrolled in Desire to Learn. And there are two mindsets about that. One is that, well, people are paying for the course, you really shouldn't just tell anybody they can come, but that's not really true, because as we're learning from MOOCs, it's better for everybody, the more people are having. So I always encourage people to join my courses, and I might invite people who are interested, one or two at first, and then if someone who took the course, when I started doing it in 2004, I would invite them back. All the spaces that we put up, everything was always there. People did come back. We have some people who've been back several times. So participants are welcome for free or for a fee. It doesn't matter. And I think everyone kind of likes that setup. That's my impression anyway. So we have a little community built up around this multi literacy course. And also another difference between what I was doing and what other people have been doing. This actually came from, I got a mistake there, that's not Scanlon, it's Scanlon, Scallon, the N should be an L, so that would make it correct. But anyway, it's correct in the, in my references. But they did some work in the 70s and 80s, actually, on the way children interacted with online environments, which was very new at the time. And prior to that, the instructional model was a conduit, and where things played, even the first computers that ran off of cassette tape. So conduit was the way you delivered instruction. But berry bush is more random access, and it's where people can, you present a berry bush. The idea of the berry bush is you feel like you'd like to eat a few berries, you go to the berry bush, you pick the berries that are easily available, that look large, that have no thorns around them, you pick the ones that you like, and then when you had few berries, then you possibly don't feel like you need to consume them anymore. Ayurveda? Ayurveda? Okay, so the materials that I set up were meant to be a berry bush. They're meant to be a supermarket, a menu in a restaurant. You're not supposed to eat everything. You're supposed to just see what's there and take what you would like to take. So there have been some misunderstandings in my course about that. And also, because of this, in my course, the tasks that were assigned were always sort of optional. There was also a berry bush full of tasks. But my idea was that the participants could do the ones that they were interested in and then use those as to discuss them amongst themselves. And always the way it works in practice in my course is we often pick one thing and then sort of pursue that for a week or maybe even two, you know. So and also I've encouraged my students always to chronicle what they've done in need portfolios. To keep some sort of record, some sort of space. Everyone's blogging now, it seems, back then. I had to ask the students to blog, and for some of them it was the first time. So we've been doing that for quite a while. We're running the courses in that way. And here are some of the spaces that we use. Listservs, we use Yahoo Groups, but I'm very impressed with Google Groups and the Google web spaces. This is important. We're using Moodle for some time, and Ning up to last year. I just announced in the Ning that I can't use it anymore. It's come up to 150 members. It's too difficult to try to have to mess around. You delete members every time you want someone else wants to join. Sorry. My microphone. We use blogs and wikis. The students have their own. A lot of our interaction goes on in the posting and commenting associated with blogs and wikis. And we tag items and try to aggregate content on tag. And specify. The link there is a really nice. You can click on that one. You can see how specify works to aggregate on our tab. Our tag, which is EVONLIT. That seems pretty, some people say that looks like something distasteful, but anyway, that's our tag. And you can do the same thing with Twitter. You can search on EVONLIT in Twitter. Of course, Twitter doesn't really do very well about archiving, so once the course gets started, though, it gets better. Lots of things to look at. Facebook, we have a group, Facebook group. We also have curated sites, such as PageFlex, for example. That's one I set up some time ago. And I might encourage students to use that as a neat portfolio site. Scoop.it is one that I've recently discovered, which I really like. But again, you can click on any of those links and you can see what some of those look like in the context of that course. So basically, this course, the neat thing about this course is I really haven't been very constrained in. You know, I don't have, for this particular course, this online course, for the EBO sessions, of course, the system up is like, you know, they just have to be popular enough to run, you know, people have to like them, accept them. For the PPOT courses, they've been, people have pretty much let me do what I want to do, which is nice, no one's bothered me. And the students, I meet the students at TESOL conferences sometimes, and they tell me that they like the course, it's different, you know. So they get used to the things that we're trying to do in that. But so because of that, it's become an incubator of ideas for me. And I would say it's really kind of a lab, situation, because, you know, it's uncontaminated. That's given me a great opportunity. But in the PPOT course, I've had to evaluate students. I can tell the front office if the students have to fail. So I do that by using ePortfolio. And I don't really evaluate the ePortfolio beyond the fact that if the student has done them or not. So meanwhile, along comes MOOC, Massive Online Open Course. And there have been, since 2008, when the first one was run, it was the CPK08 in 2008. It was started by George Stevens and Stephen Downs. And Dave Cormier was quite involved in that. And because of that, Jeff Lebeau was also involved, webcasting a lot of their events. And in this summer, there have been several MOOCs. One of them is EduMOOC. And the EduMOOC people decided that they needed, that there was a Wikipedia entry needed for Massive Open Online Courses, so they put one up. There was a bit of documentation there, and there are also these MOOCs that if you're interested in them, for example, there's one on called Epcot MOOC right now. Epcot MOOC I'm getting distracted because I'm reading about Scoop It here in the text chat. I'd like to know what's going on with Scoop It. I haven't really noticed anything different than anyway. So Epcot MOOC is going on right now. It's a MOOC about ePortfolios. It's kind of nice because it's only got about a couple hundred people, so it's not quite as massive as some of the other ones. These MOOCs get 2,500 people in them. And there are some coming up. Well, there's some courses at Stanford, for example. There's a link there that you can see some of these courses. They don't really call themselves MOOCs, but they're part of what I think is a movement in education, and that is going from from formal education into lots of experimentation with informal modes of education. The neat thing about the Stanford courses is, just like the MOOCs that Siemens and Downs are running, there are university courses which might have some paid participants. And with those people, they give the teachers, Siemens and Downs, will give feedback. But for everybody else, the other 2,400 people, they get their feedback from the network. Okay, so, and the difference between the Stanford courses and that is that the facilitators are expecting like 5,000 people to enroll for them, and they're going to actually give certificates to everybody who somehow manages to survive that course. I'm not sure how they're going to. Well, they have a way of doing it. They have something with Amazon. They're going to get tests. It's a little bit different from the MOOC structure. But anyway, it's another experiment in open online courses. Because anybody, again, can take the course. It's on the link you see. Here's a little bit of literature on MOOCs. These are some really nice studies. The Macaulay, Stewart, Siemens, and Cormier piece is well worth reading, very readable as well. And Rita Kopp did a really nice bit of research on the Plink PLE, Personal Learning Environment, MOOC that ran in 2010. So you can click on those links if you feel like it, have a read while we're talking. Well, what is a MOOC? Dave Cormier, again, has a really nice set of videos that are quite, they're almost viral. And you can find them conveniently linked from the Black Hole's page, or you can go to YouTube and put in Dave Cormier MOOC video, or just Dave Cormier MOOC, and you'll find those three videos. And I'm going to run down what they say about this here in this presentation. So the first video is on what is a MOOC. And basically, a MOOC is a course, it's an event, it's a way for people to collaborate and engage in the learning process. It's open, and that means you might have to pay, as I mentioned, for certification on completion, but you don't pay to take the course. It's free for anybody to take it. All the work then is shared. Everyone, when you put something up, it's yours. It doesn't go into a university repository. It's participatory. That's essential. The participants don't really complete assignments, per se, but they engage in material with each other. And the material can be anywhere on the web. And the idea is that they make connections between the ideas and other people in the course. So this, there's more about this. They're distributed, and they use spaces like the ones we're using for our multiple literacies course. By the way, is my Skype making noise on this chat? If so, please leave a text message and I'll switch it off. Okay, anyway, so the elements of it in the videos, tweets, all the tagged items are all over the web. And there's no one way through the materials. Participants will build a knowledge base as they participate in the course. So, and they support lifelong learning. They develop learner independence. They encourage learners to work in their own spaces. One of the most important things is that they let learners create networks, or personal learning networks. And so they promote really the kind of network creation that lifelong learning is all about. And also, they allow learners to decide if they have succeeded in the course themselves. So there's no, for people who just participate in a MOOC. Okay, looking at a sound problem there. Okay, so anyway, people, when they participate in a MOOC, they give themselves their own rewards. Monitoring the new sound problem. Okay, good. Alright. Fine. Okay. So now, the second video is about success in a MOOC. What do you do when you are confronted with 24,999 other people in your course? How do you deal with that? So, Dave has a really nice video that tells people what they need to do. First of all, when you go to the MOOC, you have to orient on it. So if you click on Goodbye Gutenberg, for example, you would see that you'd orient yourself in that course. You're not expected to do it all, so you have to decide, well, what areas do I want to focus on? And then you declare yourself. Once you've oriented, you start posting, tag your posts so people can find them, and you'll start networking. You'll find other people that will start commenting on their posts, or they might comment on yours. Happy day. So you're starting to get a little traction in this MOOC. Start replying, discussing concepts. And then eventually you'll find that of those 2,400 people, you can ignore about 2,490 of them, and you can sort of cluster with the ones who are really interested in what you're interested in. You sort of find you start developing your PLN through this little cluster of people. And then if you're really going to succeed, then you're going to maybe try to get those people to help you, or you'll find ways to mutually help each other with the course. So. Dave's third video is about knowledge limit, and that's an important concept. The people who put on MOOCs don't assume, or I should say MOOCs are created. They have appeared, they've been invented, or they've invented themselves in response to the fact that there is not one set of knowledge. Knowledge is changing. You know, knowledge is, it's impossible now for any one person to have a certain knowledge. You can't learn something in college and then use it for the rest of your life. Knowledge is negotiated. It emerges. Direction is unpredictable. constantly evolving. In a MOOC, you'll find that theme will develop in the course. And people might go off on themes rather than stay, you know, what's there in the course. George Dean told me one time that it was his job to provide coherence. And that's the idea, is to give, in Goodbye Gutenberg, for example, there's stuff there, there's the berry bush. But then the students can go off and make berry pie if they like. Thank you, Mary Janine. Mary Ann, I was just about to answer that question. That's an open online course. Okay, so anyway, one nice thing about a MOOC is that participants in the MOOC can see how their knowledge relates to other people's knowledge, the other people in the field. And a successful MOOC will produce a knowledge base that might even create new knowledge in the field, which would be really nice. So I think everybody, if you participate in a MOOC, you don't want to think that you have to do it everything that's there, but at least, you know, when I participate in MOOCs, I feel if I get something from it, it's kind of like Twitter. You can click on the Twitter link and you can learn something. So that's a plus. Don't be too worried about what you're missing. Well, obviously, George Siemens, being a proponent of MOOCs, is coming from his ideas on connectivism. There's a seminal link on that. I listened to a couple of his talks and I transcribed them in the paper that I produced. And in this video that you see, in fact, you see George Siemens right there about to say, have you ever thought about how completely irrelevant structured learning is? Now, if that sounds a little bit radical to you, you can go on and listen to that video and see why he said that. But he's talking a little bit about the in this particular slide that I have up, I think actually this is another video. This is an interview, a video of an interview that Howard Rheingold had with him. Rheingold was kind of challenging him on the chaotic aspects of this. But George Siemens said, I'm not aware of any research that actually says the linear structure produces better outcomes than more chaotic meandering structure. Our intent, based on our theories of learning, is to argue that the experience of learning, making sense of that chaos, is actually the heart of the learning experience. But if an instructor makes sense of that chaos for you, and gives you all the readings, and sets the full path in place for you, then to a degree, you're eviscerating the learner's experience, because now you've made sense of these things you're trying to teach, and all you've told the learners is, walk the path that I've formed already. But when it comes to complexity, Siemens says he's a great fan of letting learners hack their way through that path and getting the value of that learning experience and that sense-making process. So that's viable if you have the right kinds of students. Okay, so he also wants to encourage students to really broaden their networks to think of global participants, recognizing that the knowledge that you need to learn a complex subject matter is not going to be contained in one individual, not going to be contained in one institution likely. It's going to be distributed. And as a result of that distribution, we need to design a distributed learning model. So that's kind of what MOOCs are doing and what Stanford is doing in these courses that it's just put on. And we have other examples, as the Khan Academy, for example, and some other, the Khan Academy is nice. Maybe somebody has a link for that, they can put that in. And Ethan, thank you very much for your link. I will get that put on the recording. Okay. I had come up with a concept, because my courses don't attract so many people, I've come up with what I call a MOOC minuscule as an online course. So now I realize that this is controversial. Dave Cormier would certainly argue that you cannot have a MOOC if it's not massive, because critical mass is where you get the reactivity. That's how people come up with their ideas. It's got to be a critical mass. You can't do it with 12 people. So But if you happen to have 12 people, it doesn't mean that you can't run a variation on a MOOC. It's still going to be extremely student-centered, highly networked, and do it that way. You can present rich content to let the students choose from it, as is in the Berry Bush. You can provide the coherence in a personal learning environment. You can make that sort of thing, and let the participants navigate the curriculum according to their interests and individual choices. So, again, if you have the right kinds of participants, you can possibly run amok, I would say. The students don't necessarily like this. I find, well, it's not that they don't like it. I think they like it, but they don't understand it right at first. They mostly prefer to have content laid out for them. And nobody really likes to have to, oh, I got to think about this. You know, I got to make my own order from this chaos. So at first they find that the content is overwhelming. They complain about that a little bit. They really don't understand that we're trying to teach in the multiple literacies course how to filter the materials, how to set the filters to deal with the fire hose. We're trying to sift from the fire hose. So, and the idea is to use whatever materials are there, whatever you happen to read, as a catalyst for developing knowledge and sense making. So also, participants misinterpret the role of the facilitator. They sometimes feel the facilitator is not facilitating. That was a common complaint in the EduMOOC that just happened. Facilitators aren't facilitating. I don't know. That's good. They're giving the learners space to go and make their own content, their own sense. That's the idea. Where's the center? That always comes up. Where is this course? Well, it's all over the web, you know, it's in all these spaces. Why can't we just have one space, you know? Anyway, so then that's where Cormier's ideas, you know, are so important. But I think the people who like this kind of challenge, they tend to come back, so they validate kind of what we're doing. Now also, I think in a program of study where you're likely, like in PPOT, for example, you're likely to have many different courses running, you need balance in this program. You do need some courses that lay things out for people and give people steps. People have to have steps, especially at the beginning level. But also, you don't want to run all your courses so you never get people in the deep end. You teach people the motions of swimming, but you never take them swimming. That's it. At some point, people really need to know, how do I go from here to the real world? And there's also the interesting risk of the narrows. We were having a discussion in one of my personal learning networks about the Shallows, which is Nicholas Carr's book on that topic. Really nice book. Highly recommended reading. His idea is that that we're reading, and we're thinking and reading in breadth rather than in depth, because the internet is multitasking, distracting so much. So, David Weinberger's response to that, well, what about the narrows, which is narrowing the richness of shared experience to a manageable trickle? So that's the problem as well. So I think that chaos leads to learning because it forces people to resolve their doubts. And some things can be trained. An example I like to learn use with language learning is I can train people to sing Karajaka, but I can't train them to speak French. With French, you need a higher level of understanding, of resolving complexity. So that's what a MOOC environment would help people do. It works for courses like mine because this course happens to be about mobile literacy, so the way of dealing with the course is the subject matter itself. The participants are mature learners. They're motivated, they're passionate, they usually self-select to be there. And the subject matter is complex. It's not something that's really simple. You get your grip on it, you have to get into the chaos to figure it out. And the knowledge required is partly ineffable. Ineffable means that you have to experience it. You can't explain it to someone. They actually have to go online, and because a lot of people, of course, have the idea that online, what I, you know, until they try learning in this way, they don't really see what's so compelling about it. And Lastly, the assessment of participants' is constructiveness, formative, under their control. The way I do this with me portfolios, which I think that's the last part of my presentation. Before I get into me portfolios, let me mention that this might not work if you have immature or inexperienced learners. Learners cannot articulate the literacies that are required for learning in this way, or if they're unmotivated. Or if your emphasis is on training, maybe it's not the best idea. If you're learning the alphabet, put people in a MOOC. You know, it's not. But anyway, for simple or simplified material, you think simplification is essential to bringing people up to a level where they could then MOOC, then this might not be the way to go for those students. Or, and that's also the case where teachers are teaching to the test, that is, the assessment instruments don't really address what's being taught, you know, so that happens sometimes. There's a really nice presentation here by Justin Gorski. If you click on that, you'll see some ways that she suggested that MOOCs might have applications for middle and high school students. And she was a MOOC participant, and that came up with that really nice slideshow. Okay, George Stevens also talked about standards. This is something that if you think we're throwing standards out the window, Stevens has addressed that. But he repeats often that we can't know why students take our courses. So, and that's why he says a formal learning process is irrelevant for meaningful learning. But he acknowledges, of course, that schools have to have their standards. But sense-making and meaningful learning emerge, he thinks, from intrinsic processes more than from extrinsic ones. So the idea is to design courses that will give students intrinsic reasons to learn. Okay, so that brings us into me portfolios. Since I don't have this problem of teaching to the test, I can sort of make my own exit criteria. I have decided really to go with e-portfolios or me portfolios too. These allow students to, or participants, to specify their own course objectives and then to present some kind of plan for reaching those objectives and then document how they accomplish their plan. Of course, they can fine-tune along the way. It doesn't have to be a blog with all kinds of different things in it, but basically I want to see evidence that they have at least addressed this issue of why they're there, what they're planning to learn, and how they accomplish some of their goals. And you'd be so surprised at what they come up with. There is a link coming up where you can click in and see. Well, many rationales for e-portfolios. One of the most famous e-portfolio person, and so far I'm the only one saying e-portfolio, is Helen Barrett, and there are some links here to her blogs, and she also happens to be one of the facilitators in the EPCOT MOOC course going on right now. So if you're, and it's going on through September, so you can still join that if you want. Another really neat presentation is this one on Googlios, which is part of the K-12 online conference in 2009. And this was a presentation that not only told about, gave a good rationale for e-portfolios, but tells you how you can mount them using Google. Now, Maria Sol in the text chat says September, ? Yeah, the EPCOT MOOC is going on right now. If you find my slideshow somewhere, you can go back some slides and find a link to it, or just Google EPCOT MOOC, and you'll find. Okay. Yes, using MOOC would be difficult in areas where there are network problems. Okay. Another person who's written a bit on MOOCs that sort of just kind of jumped out at me. Thank you. And then DC11 has been posted. Put the link for the slide show there. So you can click on the slideshow, it'll open up the slide presentation, and all these links will come alive for you. Okay, well, Trent Batson, I don't know much about him, but he does say some things I like. He has said in one place, the learning management system may seem like the quintessential academic technology application, but instead, the ePortfolio is. ePortfolio is the learning technology of this age. In another place, he gives 10 rules of teaching in the century, and the last four of them, last three of them, 8, 9, and 10, refer to ePortfolios. When you're teaching in this century, make sure your students have a digital repository of some sort, an ePortfolio system, a wiki, a blog, a web page builder, a place to store and manage the evidence of their active learning, and require the students to interpret their collected online evidence at regular intervals. And finally, in capstone web presentations. And make this collection of evidence the primary work of the course. In other words, students should be graded largely or entirely on their final portfolio for the course. In a learning-centered course, the portfolio is the sine qua non. So I certainly agree with that, and we feel that said portfolios are learner-centered, learning management systems are not. George Siemens addresses that issue as well in one of those videos. He said that the learning management systems, because they used to use a Moodle, is too centric for them. Okay, e-portfolios go along with what I've said elsewhere about paradigm shifts. If you want to read more about the paradigm shifts that I suggest teachers and everybody, you know, knowledge workers in this day and age are going through at the moment, then you can read that article if you like. I find that students, when I talk to them about ePortfolios, there's usually a, yes, I'm about finished, thank you, 10-minute warning. Yeah, there's usually, they ask questions, so I need to model ePortfolios for them. So I'll show you what I do now when they ask you to model for them. This link at the very bottom there is their ePortfolios link. What I do is I create a portfolio, an ePortfolio that shows the portfolio of their portfolio. I'll probably do this in a wiki next time. Set up a wiki and give them each a page and a link on a sidebar and have them just start filling in links to their ePortfolios. An ePortfolio can be your own blog. It can be something you've already started. It should have a section on it though that talks about this course that you're in right now. Okay, I think that's about it. Well, thank you very much. I suppose we have some time for questions. 9 minutes, I guess.
Yes, thank you. There is time for questions. That's wonderful. About 9 minutes. And there were questions. And really, it's fascinating to see this MOOC conference online course movement. And it's really an example of collective intelligence. Everybody contributes, grow, exchange, interact. It's really fascinating. There was some question, I think Priscilla had a question, I found that question about people are writing and the screen moves. If you please stop writing. She said that some people are moving in the course at their own pace, and it doesn't matter that you read all content, and other ways for the facilitators to go back and review the information maybe that may be overlooked. That was the question, I think, from Priscilla.
Yeah, two ways to answer that question. One way is to look at what Jeff Lebeau is doing. I'm not sure how Jeff is following EduBook, but he became a fixture in it by running these weekly webcasts, Google Hangouts, really. So Google Hangouts is kind of new. Jeff is a master at putting on these online events and making them happen and record them so everyone is really engaged and joins in. So we had a little cluster of people there who were coming to these the hangouts, yeah, for the Ed edginess. And so I would say that was kind of a group of people, a cluster, that sort of started networking with one another. And the other question was, let's see, the other way to answer the question, what do people do? Funny, I kind of had another way of addressing that, but I can't remember what it was. Maybe we should take another question and I'll think of it. A question from Ali, how can we make assessment and evaluation more constructive in everyday practice? Well, I suppose that depends on the constraints you have in your own environment. You know, in the purest sense, the thing that MOOC addresses is knowledge required is changing so rapidly that really to stay on top of it, you have to be constantly percolating. And that's, if your goal is to increase your knowledge in a field where knowledge is changing, then MOOC is a good way to go about it. But if your knowledge is prescribed, or what you're supposed to gain from the course is prescribed and possibly tested in a way that's not really addressing what you really want people to learn, then you're going to possibly have a little bit of a problem with that. And I remember now what the second way I was going to address that other question was, how do the facilitators keep track of 2,800 people, or 2,500 people? Well, the way Stephen Downs wrote a little script that he calls it the Grasshopper, and it goes and aggregates content on the tag, and it puts that content in a newspaper, or what he called the daily. And so that's one way to do it. It's obviously got to be done by machine. Okay, watching the whiteboard for blank, anything else? One question about what help can you give to enable Electronic Village Online to happen in Nigeria? That's easy. You can go. You just need to go to the EVO Sessions website. I don't know if I can put it in here. So you just have to visit the website.
Earlier there was a question, yeah, how can MOOC students overcome the properly filter information?
Okay, I'm typing, let's see, I had that one in the link for the EVO session. Yeah, so you go there, any participants can go there to that link in January and get a 2-month course, 5-week course, something like that, in January and February, and take those sessions. So in Nigeria, you can do that. They're welcome to do that. They're free. The multiple literacies, how can MOOC students filter information? Well, that's, again, this is part of the chaos that you have to learn. You know, you can't, and it's ineffable. So you can't really explain so much as you just do it. You know, it's kind of like, how do you figure out who's tagging your photos on Facebook? You know, you figure it out. Most people figured out Facebook, or a lot of people have anyway. And so Facebook being kind of an example of something, or Foursquare, or, you know, some other sites that people seem to be connecting to one another in, you've got to filter out a lot of information. So you might, well, with Twitter, for example, I might search on my name, so I'll see if anybody's mentioned me. It's one of the first things I do. And that, you know, just leads me to things I really should see. And, I make lists. So, I can, like a course, if I'm running a course and I think students should be, like a multiple literacy course, I'll make a list of people who are in the course and I'll go to that list and check their tweets. Or in a conference, you can also make, people will post at conferences to the conference tag, and you can make lists of their tweets, for example. So there are ways that you use the tags to filter and to aggregate content on those tags, and that's something really that you need to learn.
All right.
In Second Life. Mm-hmm. another question about who looks good in self-organized in Second Life. Yes, they do. SL Experiments is, you could look that up. SL Experiments. And that's Nergis Kern's group. She's, and there's also the Second Life conference coming up. So yeah, there's places where, I don't really know of a MOOC that's actually taking place in Second Life, but, you know, entirely, but certainly it's part of it. And EBO sessions also go in Second Life. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, it's a matter of time, Vince.
Sure.
I think we need to finish because I have to move on to the next session and open up the screen. So thank you very much. It was really very enlightening and very informative and exciting and inspiring. And we'll see each other soon in the MOOC. And it's a very interesting names we have. Moodle Moot, EduMOOC. we are floating. We are swimming in the sea of collective intelligence learning. That's wonderful. Okay, thank you very much.
That's how it happens these days.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me. I appreciate it.
Yes, thank you very much. It was a pleasure.